Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll first speak with former speechwriter for President Bill Clinton, Paul Glastras, to get a sense of what the still popular former president might deliver tonight in his keynote speech at the Democratic Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. Then the popular radio personality and commentator Jim Hightower joins us. He, along with 20 prominent Democrats, wrote an open letter to the Democratic leadership, how Democrats can get back on offense. And we will discuss the letter and how it was received, as well as review the First Lady's widely praised speech and what former President Bill Clinton will bring to the convention tonight. Then finally, following the announcement by the UN that over 100,000 refugees fled Syria in the month of August, we will speak with Gillian Schwedler, who is a specialist on Jordan, where most of the Syrian refugees are ending up in UNHCR tents in the blistering hot desert. We will get a sense of how the fragile kingdom is handling the ongoing humanitarian disaster next door and how Jordan is still coping with the massive influx of refugees from the last war in Iraq. And joining us now is Paul Glastras, who is the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly and a senior fellow at the Western Policy Center in Washington, D.C. From September 1998 to January 2001, he was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton. He wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to health care to the budget. Before joining the White House, Paul Glastras spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News and World Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Glastras.
Well, thanks for having me.
And I take it you're not the author of tonight's speech that Bill Clinton will be giving before the Democratic Convention in Charlotte.
No, my understanding is that President Clinton is the author, or at least he and his unnamed staff and speechwriters were hard at work down to the very end working on it.
Well, that's apparently the way it is with him, isn't it? Everything is...
Absolutely. I'm reminded by my former boss, chief speechwriter Michael Waldman, in a story in the New Republic today that when he spoke in 1996 at the Democratic Convention, that his motorcade was pulling into the venue, and the helicopter, the news camera from the helicopter zoomed in, and there was the speechwriter Michael Waldman with the laptop, glow of the laptop, very visible on screen, typing away on the speech, literally tweaking it at the last minute. And the announcer said, this is a lesson to all you kids out there. Don't wait to the last minute to finish your homework.
So, Paul Glastras, what do you think the Obama team want from Bill Clinton tonight? What do they expect and what do they hope?
President Clinton is probably the best communicator, in our lifetime, certainly, maybe ever, of substantive policy information. No one is better at boiling down complex policies and ideas and programs in language that anyone can understand, and doing it in a way that is balanced and fair, and yet, obviously, as a politician, framed to do maximum damage to the opposition and maximum benefit for his side. I think what the main thing that they're asking, that he's going to do, is, in addition to his very presence advertising that the last time a Democrat was in the White House, the economy went through a rare and wonderful period of growth in which income at all levels of society grew. The main thing that he's going to do, I think, is frame and be specific about the policies of Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan. We went through a campaign, a convention last week, the Republican convention, in which dozens of speakers over 3 days spoke, and I don't think any American got a specific sense of what a Romney-Ryan policy agenda is. It was all, we're going to cut taxes and we're going to strengthen Medicare and we believe in a woman's right to choose and so forth, but really no specificity at all. And I think what the president is going to do is bring specificity to it in a way that will be, I think, accurate but also appalling to a lot of Americans.
So President Clinton is He's in his post White House life with his foundation, etc. Has become an elder statesman and has reached out to former President Bush Sr. With a lot of bipartisan efforts in Haiti and other places. So it's not likely, I would imagine, that Bill Clinton will be throwing red meat to partisan Democrats, right?
Oh no, I don't think it'll be red meat in an angry or a vitriolic sense. I think he's going to stick to a, as I said, a description of the choice that faces the American voter, and he's going to get specific about what it is the other side is aiming to do with their plans. Put it in layman's terms. He's going to then say, this is what Barack Obama has done and is aiming to do. Here's why you ought to choose Barack Obama. I think it's going to be an informative speech, obviously weighted to Obama. It's going to be an argument. I don't think he's going to say nasty things about Mitt Romney. Quite the contrary. I think he'll say he admires his business acumen and his family, and he's a good American, but that his policies would be disastrous, and if you want the same economy or something like it that we had in the 90s, choose Barack Obama.
So how is the Bill Clinton? Well, do you expect Paul Glastras, again, the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly and a senior fellow at the Western Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and from September 1998 to January 2001, he was special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton. He wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to health care to the budget. And before joining the White House, Paul Glastras spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News and World Report. Now, curiously, the famous line from the 92 campaign that elected Bill Clinton was, it's the economy, stupid. That's largely been expropriated now by Mitt Romney. They're running on it's the economy, stupid, and hoping that enough people will be upset with the economy that they'll vote for them. So it seems to me that one of Obama's challenges has always been how to not own this economy that George W. Bush handed him. And a part of the reason why we had that crash in 2008 was to do with Bill Clinton's getting rid of the Glass-Steagall Act. So do you expect any kind of mea culpa in the context of giving the Democrats clean hands about the economic disaster that befell us in 2008?
So I guess I'd say, first of all, I'm not sure that getting rid of the Glass-Steagall Act had much of anything to do with the crash. I mean, it probably wasn't a wise thing to do. It was, the Glass-Steagall Act, it was so full of holes by then. It didn't amount to much, and I think the idea that it had anything to do with the crash itself has been largely debunked. But sure, it's the case that the pro-financial policies that were carried out in the 90s and then advocated by some Clinton administration members, subsequently in the aughts, contributed to the general financialization of the economy, which was part of the environment in which this housing bubble and the subprimes and all that happened. And I wouldn't be surprised if President Clinton acknowledged that he and lots of other people were not attuned enough to that and contributed to that. I can see him doing that.
Well, as you know, the Occupy movement, for example, Paul Glastras, that has been about the only manifestation of protest against what's happened to the economy, apart from the Tea Party, which in a way is still mystifying to me how they were able to run away with anger at Wall Street and create this kind of AstroTurf movement that in many ways is being at the bidding of a handful of billionaires. I've never understood how the Democrats lost the populist rage at what happened on Wall Street. I'm just wondering, you know, for example, if there was a strong message about that, and I think it's clearly the subtext. It was the subtext of the speech last night by the First Lady, you know, showing compassion towards those that have been affected by this economy. And so many people have subsequent to it, and particularly in the Occupy movement, have basically said a plague on both their houses because they both get money from the same people. So I'm suggesting here that maybe that a way to differentiate the Democrats from the Republicans in terms of the direction the country's heading into a plutonomy controlled by oligarchs might well be good medicine.
Well, I think Barack Obama has a record that if you know, I would urge him to run and be proud of and speak about even tonight of having essentially re-regulated Wall Street along the same patterns and in the same basic ways as FDR regulated Wall Street in the 30s, and having created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which if the president doesn't, is reelected and has a chance to protect it and it grows, has the potential to really change the business model of finance in this country so that banks are in the business of lending people money when they need it so they can grow their wealth and get ahead rather than through predatory loans that essentially sap people's wealth. So, you know, I think that against a united front of Republican opposition, the president passed reasonably tough and quite comprehensive financial reform, including the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, that the Republicans want to gut. And it's something you ought to be proud of. And it might not mollify some folks who thought it didn't go far enough and didn't break up the big banks and so forth. And, you know, we can have a debate about that, but it was a considerable achievement. And, you know, the jury's not out on it, but the profits of Wall Street are down. And a lot of the proprietary trading offices at the big banks have been shut down. And the honeypot of profits are being dried up and bonuses are down. So early signs are the thing's working. And that's something to run on.
Well, I think Paul Glasser says no question that at least the framing of the 99% versus the 1% is an enduring political fact. And I don't think you could have a more tailor-made representative of the 1% than Mitt Romney.
That's right.
And my sense is that President Obama ought to make those distinctions and raise the alarm about the growing disparity of wealth in this country. If you have a situation where just one family in America, the Waltons, the heirs to the Walmart fortune, have a fortune that's equivalent to the entire wealth of the 40% of the bottom in America, it's an appalling fact.
You know, I think that we saw it this summer in some of the ads that not just the Obama super PACs, but the campaign itself ran against Mitt Romney about the actual record of Bain and the empty claims of job growth and the shutting down of the steel mill and the rapaciousness of private equity. I think that had a tremendously powerful effect. You apparently saw it in the Obama campaign, saw it, the Romney campaign saw it in internal polling. A lot of other polling picked up. He was going to run on being Mr. Business Fix It and a private equity guy, and he in August more or less abandoned that because of the success of that attack by President Obama. But I think what you're going to see now is a subtler, and we've been seeing it this week, right, at the Democratic convention, a subtler argument than what you just laid out. It's along the same lines, but it's one that essentially says an economy. There are two visions of the economy. Right? There's the top-down, cut taxes for the wealthy and the rest of us will benefit version, which is the Republican view. And then there's the middle class out. Whatever helps the middle class helps the economy view, and that's the Democratic vision. I think that gets across some of what you're saying, but does it in a way where you don't necessarily, as a voter, have to agree with the larger plutocratic arguments that you're making, which resonate with a lot of people, but don't resonate with a lot of people.
So, Paul Glasrost, just back to tonight's speaker, your former boss, President Bill Clinton. You wrote over 200 speeches for him. Apparently, we're told that the conventional wisdom about the American electorate, where the center decides, is no longer the case. That we've become so polarized that the center doesn't really matter. And I'm just wondering, one, whether that's true, and whether Bill Clinton could go after the undecided, who might well, if persuaded, vote for Obama.
So it's certainly the case that a number of people who are truly undecided has shrunk over the years. There's still a huge swath of Americans that say that they're independent, but when you actually look at their voting patterns, they almost always vote for one party or another, and the independent is really just a label. But when you look at the people who are likely to vote and yet that might not have, that have not made up their minds, it is a vanishingly small group. It's maybe 7% of the population. And then you look at the states where their votes, with a number of votes that small, might make a difference, i.e. the swing states, and you're talking about 7, 8, 9, 10 states, maybe fewer. So we're talking about a universe of 1 million to 3 million people, right? Those are the people who are going to decide the election, and there are not a lot of them. But when you get one of them, you automatically rob the other side of a vote. So they're twofers. Whereas if you just get one of your already decided voters to the polls, that's just one vote for you. So that middle voter is still very, very important, and is hugely important in the swing states. So any good convention speech has to both gin up the enthusiasm of the base and be appealing to a persuadable voter.
Well,
and that's where the skill of writing these things comes in.
Well, Paul Glasrost, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Paul Glasrost, who's the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly, and he's a senior fellow at the Western Policy Center in Washington, D.C. From September 1998 to January 2001, he was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton. He wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to healthcare to the budget. And before joining the White House, Paul Glasrost spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News & World Report. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with Jim Hightower.
gotta organize and make it happen, you heard? Justice and freedom, what you want? Let's get organized. We gon' survive if we don't. Let's get organized. Power in numbers, come on. Let's get organized. Don't just be singing the song. Let's get organized. Justice and freedom, what you want? Let's get organized. We gon' survive if we don't. Let's get organized. Power in numbers, come on. Let's get organized. Don't just be singing the song. Let's get organized.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jim Hightower, a national radio commentator, writer, and public speaker, twice elected Texas Agriculture Commissioner. He is a New York Times bestselling author of 7 books, including Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, and Thieves in High Places. They've stolen our country and it's time to take it back. He, along with 20 prominent Democrats, sent an open letter, How Democrats Can Get Back on Offense, to the Democratic congressional leadership, urging them to get back on offense by exposing the GOP as more extreme than mainstream and proposing a positive program of progressive patriotism. The letter is available at protectdemocracy.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jim Hightower.
Hey, great to be with you, Ian.
You, along with a number of prominent Democrats, Jim Hightower, have written this letter to the Democratic leadership. Michael Eric Dyson, James Galbraith, Jennifer Granholm, Gary Hart, and Ron Reagan, Robert Reich, and Elliot Spitzer, and among others. Before we get into the content of the letter, what's been the response from the Democratic officials?
Well, practically none, but we didn't really anticipate that, I have no doubt that they are reading it and kind of stunned that suddenly progressives are saying, wait a minute, we need to actually stand up and be Democrats, which is the essence of this letter. But the real response has been from the media itself. Yours is not the first call that I've taken on this, and generators of this letter were Gary Hart and Mark Green. And all sorts of good folks, our pal Stanley Scheinbaum right there in L.A. and Fred Harris out of former populist senator out of Oklahoma. These folks. So it's a combination of people who have been longtime activists, and then people who've been in and out of government. Derek Shearer also there in Los Angeles, and Norman Lear and other great progressives are finally beginning to say, we need to be speaking out together. All of us kind of, we make our points here and there, as I do on this great KPFK radio station on a regular basis. But we need to occasionally at least stand together and say we're headed in a bad direction here. Not the Republicans are headed. They've gone from right wing to right out of their minds. It's a loopiness that is astonishing. I'm just back here in Austin where you're talking with me today from Charlotte, where I was at the convention for Progressive Democrats of America, 21st Democrats, 21st Century Democrats, and a couple of other great groups there. So also speaking to the Texas delegation. By the by, there's a revival of strong progressive Democratic politics in this state, which will amaze a number of your listeners, I imagine. People are looking for some response to this Republican nutballism that we're getting. And it can't be just the same old namby-pamby. It really has to be a vision of what America can be and should be.
Well, the letter begins, the letter to Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, Dick Durbin, Harry Reid, Senator Patty Murray, all the heads of the various Democratic congressional re-election committees and Senate re-election committees, How Democrats Can Get Back on Offense. The letter begins, Robert Frost once wrote that a liberal is someone who won't take his own side in a debate. Now, it's true. We've had some pretty dismal standard bearers. I'm thinking back of to Mondale and to Dukakis and others who I think have helped shape that kind of cliche as the wussy, feckless Democrat. I don't think Bill Clinton is in that category. He's speaking tonight, and certainly tomorrow night, I don't think Obama is a wuss.
I agree.
But still, that baggage does haunt the Democrats. And What do we need? I mean, it sounds like this, you know, we need macho progressives.
We need conviction. We need just a populist willingness to stand up for those. You know, too many of our Democrats are been as confused as goats on AstroTurf, you know, when it comes to standing up for the people they're supposed to represent. That, to me, is what we need. We need Democrats to be Democrats, essentially, as Harry Truman used to put it. You excluded Clinton and Obama. They certainly are not wusses. I agree with that. They're not John Kerry's and the Dukakis sort of softer models, but both of them have been, you know, overwhelmingly corporate Democrats. Well, that's not what the Democrat constituency actually is. The Democratic constituency is the anti-corporate. They are the people who've been knocked down by the. We've gone from Ronald Reagan's trickle-down economics to the Koch brothers' tinkle-down economics, and people are aware of that. The young folks who can't get a job anywhere near commensurate with their educational level, much less pay commensurate with it. Older workers who been shut out entirely, unable to find a job, looking for 2, 3, even 4 years for a job, and unable to get much in the way of interviews, even. The middle class, generally, 90% of the people, seeing that their incomes have been knocked down over the last 30 years, but specifically over the last 3 and 4 years. So folks know, even a dog knows the difference between being kicked and being stumbled over. We're being kicked, and people know that. And just saying, well, the Republicans are meanies, they're baddies, which they most certainly are, isn't going to mean that those folks are then going to say, okay, well, we're going to vote for you. We're going to go crazy. We're going to rally behind you. No, you have to give them some signal, fly the flag of a little d, Democratic politics again, that we're on their side and we're willing to take on those corporate powers in order to lift up the middle class majority, percolate up economics that restores America to the kind of democratic economics that we need to actually have prosperity in America. Actually, this letter quotes, it doesn't put it in quotes, but they use a quote that my father put forth many years ago. He was not a political scientist or even a political activist, but he's a small business guy, son of the Depression. He used to say to me that everybody does better when everybody does better. That's what people are looking for. You know, we've got the few doing extremely well and everybody else doing worse. People are looking for the kind of common good economics again, where everybody does better.
Well, Jim Hightower, I'm actually perplexed as to why there is such passivity on the left in this country and why there's not the recognition that we are at a critical time. I know that the Democrats, when they run out of arguments, they always say the sky is falling because if you don't vote for us, there's going to be a bunch of crazies on the Supreme Court. Well, we know that we do have a bunch of crazies on the Supreme Court. But we also surely must recognize that our economy is becoming a corporate plutonomy and our democracy is being captured by an oligarchy. And we don't have a lot of time before the deal is done and our democracy is just an irrelevant kind of game show democracy and we're a bunch of serfs. Now, you mentioned the corporate takeover of the Democratic Party. Don't you think it's high time for both Clinton tonight and Obama tomorrow night to cut bait with corporate America and frame this guy they're running against as a tool of the corporations, which he clearly is? You know, I don't understand. Clinton could actually go a long way to at least acknowledging the damage he did with getting rid of Glass-Steagall. And I think Obama could basically say, look, you know, I took a lot of money for them in 2008. Now they hate me. I mean, he's got nothing to lose, for God's sake.
I'm with you on that. I don't expect that to come from Clinton tonight. I think Obama has been doing some of this, and his willingness to take on the just exorbitant CEO pay, and to say that they've got to begin to pay a real chunk of taxes, not getting away with the Bush tax giveaway. So he's beginning to do some of it. I don't know what we'll hear tomorrow night. I hope, I'm with you, I hope it'll be a strong message that, yes, along the Franklin Roosevelt line, you know, Roosevelt was confronted by, I don't know, one of his aides or somebody who said that you're considered a class traitor and they hate you. And Roosevelt said, I welcome their hatred. That is exactly the kind of attitude you have to have as a progressive if you're going to make any difference in political office. You have to be willing to piss off the economic powers, the moneyed interests. If you don't do that, no change happens. And the only way you can do that, to make that change, is to rally the people on the outside to come inside and to put the pressure on the legislators and the government so that that we get the kind of reforms to restructure Wall Street, to decentralize Wall Street, not to regulate it. They've got lawyers out to kazoo who are expert at getting around regulations. You need to take their power away. It would be nice to see a few of them in orange jumpsuits, but that aside, they certainly should not keep their jobs, the Wall Street barons that crashed our economy, and they should have their power taken away and that money decentralized into our independent banks, into our community banks, into our credit unions, and into local control of our money. The same thing on health care. You know, why did we put insurance companies back in charge of health care? Now, the Obamacare, as it's called, does a lot of good things, but it still has insurance companies right in the middle of it, along with the big pharma, the pharmaceutical giants, right in the middle of it. We need to take those powers out of it. That's the difference between populism and liberalism. Populism says restructure. Liberalism says, well, let's regulate. Let's have more regulations. Well, we've been regulating like crazy, and of course they find their ways around it. They find their ways to become cozy with the regulators themselves, and nothing changes. Only restructuring, only a populist approach is going to actually make changes, and that's what we at a grassroots level have been fighting for, and by the way, are having success at. We're not having success nationally, but in a lot of states and in a whole lot of cities and even neighborhoods, people are making changes. Think of the food economy and the huge change that has happened there in the last 15 years, certainly the last 30 years, of people taking charge of it, consumers and farmers. No government created the organic movement. No corporation created it. That was done by individual farmers and food artisans and consumers and just local folks getting together and saying, there's got to be a better way. And they teamed together and made a better way. The farmers' markets, the direct selling to restaurants, the co-ops that sell into the international market. This is the kind of future that is a structural change that makes a long-term difference.
Well, it's in your letter that you, along with 20 other prominent Democrats, Jim Hightower, wrote to the Democratic leadership, urging them to, titled How Democrats Can Get Back on Offense. You point out that among the things that made Democrats exceptional is FDR's axiom that we pursue bold, persistent experimentation. And not only did FDR welcome the hatred of the oligarchs back in the day when they crashed the economy, he referred to them in kind of Revolutionary War terms as economic royalists. And that seems to be really where we're heading. You know, we're heading towards a kind of new, you know, it's not that the king is going to be across the Atlantic. When you look at the Romneys, and particularly their Ann Romney's very sort of transparent pleas for compassion due to her illnesses and trying to paint herself as a real person, it just doesn't work. And particularly when you compare it to Michelle Obama, who seems to be genuine in the sense that she's, you know, trying to raise a family and is basically does care for people that she grew up with, and she didn't grow up with a silver spoon in her mouth.
Exactly. I just disagree with one thing. We're not headed toward controlled by economic royalists, we're there. The Koch brothers and their gang of billionaires are now completely dominant in the politics of the Republican Party. And dominant in a lot of local races. I was with Marcy Kaptur last night. She was at an event that I attended with progressive Democrats. She's a member of Congress from Toledo, Ohio area. She got redistricted this time, faced a vicious fight with and is now facing that with money coming from Houston, Texas. That's all she knows. She doesn't know who it is. She doesn't know what the corporation is that is behind it. But $300,000 has already been spent in her congressional race against her from out of the blue. You know, well, this is economic royalism. These are like mortar shots fired from beyond the fringe with corporate funders going after members of Congress who dare to stand up, because Marcy has been a terrific fighter against NAFTA and the trade scams that the powers that be put forward. So we've got to recognize that we're already in this battle. Those people are doing that to us. And we have to say it. We have to name it as much as we can, specifically who is behind this, who is doing it, and expose it. People hate this, by the way. Just ordinary folks. There's two or three major coalitions that are fighting to repeal that Citizen Coalition, that Citizen United abomination of a decision by this, those five thugs on the Supreme Court that mugged our democracy. With that edict that says that corporations are people and that corporate money is speech. Of course, Ian, we in Texas know if a corporation was a person, we would have already executed at least one of them, and we haven't done that, so I think a corporation is not a person. But nonetheless, they're acting as people, and they're acting as superior to the people who are supposed to rule this country. We're supposed to be a government of, by, and for the people. Yet we are, and this goes back to Mary Ellen Lees in the 1880s in the populist movements, when she said that we are a government of, by, and for Wall Street.
Well, if these corporations are people, then let's have them pay income taxes like we have to pay.
There you go. Let's send them to war. I'd like to see that.
That's true.
Wouldn't you like Monsanto to have to go to Afghanistan?
Well, just... what do you think of the rising star from the Lone Star State who spoke last night, Castro brother?
Certainly gave a good speech and ignited folks. Last night was a pretty good night. You look back at that Republican convention in Tampa, and there was nothing comparable to either Mayor Castro's speech or to Michelle Obama's speech. I think that they kind of put themselves on display as the Republicans, as a sort of self-aggrandizing, self-serving bunch of individuals. There's Chris Christie giving their State of the Union speech, he almost threw his arm out of joint, patting himself on the back, and it's a pretty big back that he's got there. But I think we did show in the Democratic speeches last night. And I have no doubt that Obama will do a very, very good job on Thursday night. I don't know what to expect tonight with Bill Clinton, but I think we're showing. Well, one thing is going to happen tonight are the employees from Bain Capital, Mitt Romney's vulture capitalist firm, talking about what he did to them. That's going to be instructive. By the way, I think one of the best speeches last night was the Lily Ledbetter speech.
Oh, yeah. She's great.
Dynamite.
Yeah,
just laying it on the line with a great Alabama accent.
Exactly.
Sent a message out there. I think that was profound. So I think we got something going, but it's not enough to win an election. We have to have an agenda that actually takes on these corporate interests. And that's why I went to Charlotte, and the Progressive Democrats of America was there with John Conyers, Representative McCarthy out of the Boston area, with Marcy Kaptur, with Keith Ellison, the chair of the Progressive Caucus in the Congress, with so many good representatives there. now going to the progressive meetings, you know. So we're building, you know, we're not there yet. It's not all about Obama. We have to build incrementally, take steps, you know. My friend Willie Nelson put it like this, the early bird might get the worm, but it's the second mouse that gets the cheese. So you got to recognize it's an accumulation, a continuum, and we keep adding strength. And with Tammy Baldwin running for the Senate out of Wisconsin and Elizabeth Warren over there in Massachusetts, we have other good, really excellent candidates. Dr. Gill running in for the Congress in Illinois, got a real shot at winning there, real good progressive fellow. We've got a lot of opportunity there to add to our strength. And as we add, then we begin to bend the Democrats to that FDR ideal.
Well, just in closing, Jim Hightower, do you think there's hope for the angry white man? I mean, I watch the way the cynical Ryan and Romneys are doing their dog whistles and throwing bones and stirring up racism and class resentment against the notion that there are a bunch of freeloaders out there on welfare, and that's what Obamacare's all about, is about your health care being diminished in order to pay for a bunch of freeloaders. The whole thing is really disgraceful. I despair at the white man in this country. Is there any way to bring him back to reality?
Of course, of course. And I don't despair at all, though I certainly am dismayed and disgusted by Romney and Ryan. Certainly Romney cannot be, he is just beyond the pale of his willingness to seek power at the expense of any belief that he ever once had. It's an embarrassment to see him out there pandering to this right-wing nutballism. But I will say I'm in a state of angry white men. I know angry white men. And the key to bringing them home is, first of all, don't disparage them. They're angry for a reason, and the reason is not that the black man or that the Mexican-American or the Asian-American is getting more than they are getting. The reason they're angry is because the plutocrats are shafting them. The plutocrats are knocking them down economically and destroying the opportunities for their children to move up. They know that, but we have to have a politics and a party that advances that side of it. And if we do, then they'll move in that direction. They'll recognize, wait a minute, now you're talking about me over here. If my kid is able to get health care at birth, then that's something that I believe in, that I know that they need. And if my kid is able to go to college, we're able to control the exorbitant costs of these, even the public universities. And if my kid is able to get a job with a good wage and a pension and a possibility of upward mobility, then that's what they're looking for. They're looking for exactly what FDR offered in the 1930s across the board, whether they're working stiffs, they're farmers, they're Main Street merchants, you know, it's the same thing. We can reach those people not by anything hokey, but by appealing directly to their self-interest.
Well, Jim Hightower, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Take care.
Been a pleasure. Again, I've been speaking with Jim Hightower, national radio commentator, writer, and public speaker, twice elected Texas Agriculture Commissioner. He is a New York Times bestselling author of 7 books, including Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, and Thieves in High Places. They've stolen our country, and it's time to take it back. He, along with 20 prominent Democrats, sent an open letter how Democrats can get back on offense to the Democratic congressional leadership, urging them to get back on offense by exposing the GOP as more extreme than mainstream and proposing a positive program of progressive patriotism. The letter is available at protectdemocracy.org. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the refugee crisis in Jordan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gillian Schwedler, who is a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She's currently completing a book titled Protesting Jordan, Law, Space, and Dissent. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gillian Schwedler.
Thank you.
And clearly, Jordan is under great stress. The UN have just announced that more than 100,000 Syrians have fled their country in August, and Jordan says up to 183,000 refugees from Syria have entered the country since the uprising began, and they are currently arriving at the rate of about 1,000 a day. And my understanding is that the area on that border with Syria is fairly barren, so they're arriving into a kind of desert and entering what these sort of impromptu cities of tents.
Yes, that's correct. It is a very barren desert area, and it's the season it is now is also a season of sandstorms and windstorms. So besides it being, you know, very desolate and barren, it's they're also getting hit. And my understanding from reports is also that there's a number of health problems related to that, respiratory problems, you know, sand in the face, in the eye. So it's a bit of a difficult circumstance.
So how is the Jordanian government coping with this? Because there have been some, I wouldn't call them uprisings, but there have been some shows of defiance. On Saturday night, about 600 people led by the Muslim Brotherhood demonstrated in the capital, Amman, against the government taking off the fuel subsidies and thus allowing the price of gasoline to rise. I believe the government's had to reverse themselves on that. So it seems like King Abdullah already has his hands full without this problem with Syrian refugees.
Yes, that's correct. He definitely has his hands full. Jordan has not been immune from the Arab uprisings, the Arab Spring. It hasn't seen a massive mobilization, a unified mobilization calling for the overthrow of the regime. And in fact, a number of the people that have been protesting over the past year and a half have actually been demanding different kinds of reforms or issues from the regime, and the price hikes is a good example. So on the one hand, you have a small group, and the Muslim Brotherhood is among them, demanding reforms to make the country more democratic. You also have a number of more conservative East Bank groups that are protesting, and they want the regime, they want more regime, not a democratic regime. They want a regime that provides more subsidies, more jobs in the public sector. They want an increasingly bloated public sector. And so as Jordan is trying to lessen its public sector and limit the and gradually lift the subsidies on petrol along with some other items, so you have a group protesting that. They want the government to reintroduce those, which is what happened over the weekend. And you also have other groups protesting for more reform. And so he really does have his hands full, not even considering the refugee situation. The refugee situation, I think, has to be understood in the context of the Iraqi refugee flow, which entered Jordan in 2004. Some over 500,000, most estimate between 250,000 and 750,000 are still in Jordan, and they're not going anywhere. And so with the expectation that there would be significant numbers coming into Jordan, which is what's happening, they're very keen on not letting them into major urban centers or any place where they might settle on a long-term basis. He's very, very concerned to make sure this is a temporary phenomenon, even if it does go on for months. And I think that's the reason behind these construction of camps in very isolated areas near the border, so they're not anywhere near to where the people can get to towns and villages and settle on a more long-term basis.
But this is a country of only 6 million people, so if you have 750,000 refugees from the last war with Iraq that are still there, and then you've got on top of that the influx of refugees from Syria, which, you know, at this point it's obviously not reached 750,000, but it's getting up there.
Yeah, and I think it's actually even worse than that, in the sense that of the 6 million people that are Jordanian citizens, more than half of them are of Palestinian origin. Many came from, you know, the refugee flows of 1948 and 1967. But in any case, more than half of the population is of Palestinian descent, and the regime's primary support base are East Bankers. So you have the East Bank trans-Jordanian population, already a minority of that 6 million. Add more than 500,000 Iraqis to the mix who are going nowhere, and, you know, maybe as much as several hundred thousand Syrians, they're very, very keen to ensure that they don't get integrated, because the trans-Jordanian population is, you know, quite nervous, as these demographic numbers are very significant.
Well, again, just back to the Gillian Schwedler, again, professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She's currently completing a book titled Protesting Jordan, Law, Space, and Dissent. And we're talking about the tightrope that King Abdullah of Jordan is on, in as much as the IMF, on the one hand, are putting the squeeze on for him to cut government subsidies, and the minute he cut the 10% by 10% the price of gasoline, he was met with tremendous street demonstrations. He's had to reverse that, acting rather quickly, but he fired the sitting government, and he's been pledging political reform, and he's replaced another two prime ministers. I mean, you can't keep shuffling these guys around, can you? At some point or other, you're going to run out of heads to roll.
Yeah, it's a significant problem, and it's very much politics as usual in Jordan, that whenever there's a problem, he blames the prime minister, changes a new cabinet, issues new orders to them, but doesn't really allow them, you know, the freedom to implement new policies, to really, you know, provide a different, you know, vision and enact that. He's very, very tightly controls it. The royal court is really behind the scenes pulling the strings, and so these, you know, while you constantly have this endless supply of prime ministers to rotate in and out, the government never really lets, I mean, the king never really lets them do anything, to enact much. And so they're very, you know, constrained in their ability to accomplish anything. And as I said, there's very different constituencies that the regime is trying to balance, this conservative, tribal, core support base of Trans-Jordanians, who want, you know, subsidies to continue. They want prices to remain low. They want all their jobs in the public sector that they feel, quite frankly, are owed to them. The game has been, we provide you support, you know, to the regime, and we expect to get jobs and subsidies in return. And so the king is trying to implement these reforms mandated by the IMF, but also, I mean, he really does want that kind of economic vision of a privatized, vibrant sector. And he's being, the response to that is, you know, very strong. And so we have this being squeezed in multiple directions. The Palestinians, of course, are, you know, majority of the population, and they're, you know, politically disenfranchised. And so whenever, you know, any move he makes in any direction, somebody screams about it. And every few months, or, you know, some cases 2-3 times a year, there's a new cabinet, a call for national dialogue, and a new day, and it's really politics as usual. And I think that's not really sustainable. Jordanians are certainly wise to that tactic and aware that it doesn't really bring change.
Well, obviously this situation, you know, has its own problems, let alone the mounting problems from the war next door in Syria. I noticed in the New York Times, Gillian Schwedler, that there was a reporter in the Syrian refugee camps talking to the young kids that have escaped out of Syria, and it was quite disturbing the extent to which they want to go back and murder the Alawites. And since the Sunni, largely the victims of this civil war who are fleeing, are mostly Sunni, they're the majority, one assumes that eventually that they will win this civil war, probably at an enormous cost. But that would indicate then that Jordan will be a staging ground for a counterattack. So this war is not going to go away, surely. It's going to intensify.
I think that's true, unfortunately. I do think it's not going to go away. I think we're in for months, if not a year or more, of this. And to the extent you have this very disenfranchised population, a youth group, you know, reportedly 2/3 of the people in the camp are children, who have lost families, lost fathers, brothers, but many of whom are orphans who made their way themselves, you kind of can completely understand their anger and frustration. And what's happened, interestingly, is where it was this minority Alawite group that ruled the country, it's really morphed into a sectarian issue of Sunnis versus Shiis, as opposed to the population versus this tiny cliquish crowd. And that's unfortunate, because it's as we've seen in Iraq, once those sentiments get cemented, they can, of course, be changed, and they can change over time. But, you know, it's going to be something the country's going to have to deal with. And to the extent you have this, you know, significant Sunni population angry in residing in Jordan and wanting to get back, you could definitely see that, as you say, it being a staging ground for, you know, a movement back into Syria.
Well, just in closing, Gillian Schwedler, I mentioned that the Muslim Brotherhood led the demonstration over the weekend against the king's hiking the price of gasoline and taking off the subsidies, which he had to reverse. The Muslim Brotherhood are nothing like they as powerful as they are in Egypt, and now they essentially are in charge of Egypt, and that's had tremendous repercussions in Israel, although they haven't given up the peace treaty with Israel, even though it's very unpopular with the Egyptian people. I imagine the peace treaty that the Jordanian king has with Israel is probably unpopular too with the average citizen. And what are the chances of the Muslim Brotherhood becoming a powerful force as they are in Egypt?
Well, they are a powerful force, but I think as long as the monarchy remains intact, they'll always be a powerful opposition force. And they've always framed themselves as a loyal opposition. They've never called for the overthrow of the regime. They've never said anything not in support of the monarchy. They just want the monarch's power to be gradually diminished. So as opposed to Egypt, historically over the years, the real radicals in Jordan have been the leftists, the communist and socialist groups, the militias, the Palestinian militias, you know, of course, as well. But the leftist groups were the radicals, and the Muslim Brotherhood had been allied with the regime against them in the 50s and 60s and 70s. In Egypt, the inverse was true. It was the Muslim Brotherhood that was imprisoned, and the ostensibly socialist regime of Gamal Abdel Nasser was allied with other, you know, more leftist-minded groups. And so in Jordan, the Muslim Brotherhood was never the kind of anti-regime group that it was in Egypt or in other places. Having said that, you're absolutely right. The peace treaty with Israel is wildly unpopular, but I think, like in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood, as well as all the other groups that don't find it that popular, realize there's tremendous resources that come with maintaining that treaty from the United States, also from Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia really wouldn't want a democratic or a Islamist Muslim Brotherhood-led regime as a neighbor. It really wants the monarch to remain. And so I think I don't think the peace treaty is in any danger, even if something significant were to happen with the regime, which I also don't think is imminent. But there's a lot more pressures in Jordan than many people realize. And as I said earlier, I really think the king feels it, and he's panicking a bit, and he's scrambling, and he's trying to play a number of moving parts right now to sort of ensure primary, first and foremost, that his regime remains in power.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Gillian Schwedler.
My pleasure as always. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Gillian Schwedler, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She's currently completing a book titled Protesting Jordan, Law, Space, and Dissent. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.